Okay, everyone. So welcome once again. Nice to see you all here. And as usual, going to do a Dhamma talk now, and then afterwards you have a chance to ask some questions if you like. And the talk tonight is going to be about something that sort of happened to me, or maybe happened or not happened, something that I was part of recently. I was in Thailand about a month and a half ago. And when I was there, I did various things. I went to, one of the main things I did was go to one of the large universities in Bangkok. And this university is a monks' university, and there are some nuns there as well. And so it's like a monastic university. It's known as the Maha Chula Longkorn University, just outside of Bangkok. And I was there, I hung out there for a day or two. And one of the things that they do there, of course, is they do all kinds of academic studies, researching various things. And one of the things that they research is the what is called the Sustainable Development Goals, and its relationship to Buddhist teachings or Buddhist values. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that because I've been a bit involved with that research project. Just to kind of see if we can tie some ideas together, the Sustainable Development Goals and then the Buddhist kind of values on the other hand, and see how they compare and how they relate to each other, how they support each other, and maybe also whether Buddhism has some input into these things. What can the Buddha add to these important things? And usually you can be pretty sure the Buddha has a lot to say about things. Regardless of the area, the Buddha has something to add. Value is always there. And so the Sustainable Development Goals, these are set down by the United Nations. And I don't know if you've heard of them, but they are found on there. You can find them on the website. I did a bit of research before giving this talk to make sure at least I know a little bit about what I'm talking about, which always comes in handy. And there are seventeen such Sustainable Development Goals. And there are, as you might imagine, things like having security in the world, having sufficient resources for food, having shelter, having enough clothing, having education, having a good environment, making sure the world around us kind of functions properly. And these are kind of some of the main ideas there. Basically, the idea is to have a good life on this planet, but in a sustainable way, so we don't destroy the future for humanity or later generations or whatever. This is kind of the general idea. And I think we can probably agree that that's a good idea. Yeah, it's a good idea to kind of have a good life for everyone. Does anyone disagree with that? Just checking around to see if we have any... It kind of fits with Buddhist ideas, right? Everyone should have a good life. It's something that we can relate to as Buddhists or Buddhist sympathizer, whatever, however you see yourself as. And so that kind of makes sense. Yeah, we can agree with these ideas. But one of the things that is also interesting and to me is whether these ideas, whether they actually support Buddhist practice. And this is quite interesting because from a Buddhist point of view, yes, it's important that we have good lives, but it is also important that we have a world that enables us to practice Buddhist teachings, Buddhist principles. And that also matters enormously because sometimes the world is not in a state by which it is easy to practice Buddhist principles simply because it is too unstable or whatever. And so from a Buddhist perspective, the idea of creating a good world, creating a world where people are reasonably at ease, there's not too many wars, people have the basic necessities of life, they have them satisfied, it's a very good thing for Buddhism. And the reason is because once the basic necessities of life are satisfied, then you can kind of set your goals a bit higher. Then you can think about the spiritual life. Then you can think about the value, the deeper values that are important for human beings, not just to survive, but to flourish. And the flourishing of human beings is, to my mind, really what Buddhism is about. And I'm sure many of you have heard of what is known as the Maslowian hierarchy of needs, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's kind of standard thing that most people learn in high school or whatever. And it's this idea, and this fits in with what I'm saying now, this idea that first of all, we need to have satisfied the basic requirements in life, food, shelter, clothing, these kind of things, kind of physiological needs. And then come kind of the higher needs, and the needs for safety, the needs for feeling a sense of belonging, yeah, etc., etc. And at the top of this hierarchy is what they call self-actualization, or sometimes transcendence. Yeah, and that's where really Buddhism comes in. So if the lower parts of this hierarchy are satisfied, then the top parts become available to us. Then it becomes possible to practice the Buddhist teachings fully and actually realize something profound and interesting here. So we should applaud, yeah, the idea of creating a good world around us, that everyone is fed, because once those lower parts of the hierarchy of needs are met, then the higher ones become possible. That's where the Buddhist teachings really come into force. And when you read the suttas are the word of the Buddha, when you start to read the word of the Buddha, you see the Buddha acting in the same way. He also will look after the basic needs of people before giving the higher teachings. There are some very beautiful examples of this in the suttas. One example, an obvious one, I think it was a person who was a cow herd or something like that, and there were some cows that had kind of run away, and so he spent the whole day running, roaming the mountains and the forests of ancient India, trying to kind of get hold of his cattle, yeah? Very hard. Once they kind of go semi-wild, they're very difficult to get hold of again. So he runs around for hours and hours and eventually get hold of the cattle, and it brings them back to where they're supposed to be. And on the way back, he happens to meet an assembly of people. And this assembly of people, they're listening to a teaching. And lo and behold, the teacher is the Buddha. Yeah, that's usually what happens in the suttas. The Buddha is usually the teacher. So no surprise there. But the Buddha is the teacher. And this cowherd who has been roaming around all day, he thinks, wow, this is really cool, yeah. All these people listening to this teacher, maybe I should also lend an ear to what is happening. So he approaches the assembly. And as he approaches the assembly, the Buddha realizes that here is a person with potential. The Buddha has the ability to see the potential. He takes one look at you, looks at you, Amitā, one look, and he knows exactly what your potential is, right? He knows straight away. So, and this is kind of the power of a Buddha. It's just like we can also sometimes see the potential in people around us simply by watching their body language or whatever. So the Buddha saw this cowherd and he knew that here is someone who has the ability to realize something profound. But the Buddha also knew that there's no way that he's going to be able to listen to the teachings after running around all day, being hungry and all of these things. So when the cowherd approaches the assembly, he says to him, go and get something to eat first of all, and then come back afterwards. Yeah? I can't remember whether he actually pointed out where to get the... Anyway, he said, have something to eat, and then come back afterwards. So the cowherd goes to have something to eat. He comes back. The Buddha gives him a special teaching, and lo and behold, he has some profound insight into the nature of reality as a consequence. Yeah, and this shows you this idea of you have to satisfy the basic things in life. And the Buddha worked like that all the time, making sure that the people around him were happy, they were in a good state to receive these beautiful, beautiful teachings of the Dhamma. These are really extraordinary teachings. The more you delve into the Dhamma, the more you understand what it is about. It becomes extraordinarily profound and beautiful. And this is why it's such a joy to be able to even share these teachings, because these are life-giving in a profound sense. They give meaning, they give purpose, they give happiness, freedom from suffering, of course, and all of these kind of things. And so when you see this poor cowherd being treated in this way, actually it's very beautiful and powerful what is going on. In other cases, you see the Buddha wandering around the Ganges plain. That's where he kind of stayed most of the time, around the Ganges River in India, this magnificent river. Have you seen the Ganges River? I'm sure some of you have. It's a pretty, pretty awesome river. It makes the Swan River look like a little brook in comparison. It's kind of a really magnificent river. 2 kilometers wide, whatever. It's just... And anyway, this is where the Buddha was, and he would wander around, and sometimes he would go from one monastery to another one, and he would meet his monks. Yeah, he would go to the monastery and say, oh, how are you? And then the interesting thing here is how those conversations start. Yeah, when the Buddha meets a monk, or a lay person for that matter, the way he starts out is always by asking, how are you? Are you keeping well there? Are you having any trouble getting alms food? Yeah, because the monks got alms food. They would walk on alms. And then he would, in other words, he would look after their physical requirements before he would go on to give a teaching. Yeah, and this is how the Buddha always starts these things. And then he would ask things like, are you living in harmony? Right? Because living in harmony is such an important thing for the Dhamma to work, for us to be able to receive the message of these teachings. So this is another example of kind of how the Buddha ensures, yeah, that people are really at ease, that they are ready to hear these teachings. So this is something kind of like goes through the message of Buddha, the sense of care, yeah, that he has for the people around him, so as to enable a more profound appreciation of these beautiful teachings. So this is kind of the starting point. Yeah. So this is why I think the Sustainable Development Goals are actually helpful for Buddhists as well. It allows more people in the world to get access to these teachings. They have the basic requirements met. They have enough education to be able to understand English, yeah, because at least here the Dhamma happens in English, and etc., etc. So this is the first thing that they do, these Sustainable Development Goals. And another thing that they do, I just mentioned the idea of harmony a second ago, because these Sustainable Development Goals are about creating more equitable societies, a society where there is less gender differences, where everyone has an opportunity and a chance, where there's less discrimination and problems in society. They also are geared towards the idea of harmony, yeah? The idea of living together. When there's enormous differences in society and some people feel discriminated against, you're always going to have friction in that kind of society. Yeah, people are not going to be happy. People are eventually, they're going to revolt, and you're going to have the French Revolution, you're going to have the Australian Revolution if you go too far in differences within society. This is what happens in societies. Yeah, revolutions happen as a consequence of imbalances. And the opposite, when you have a balance, when everyone is looked after, then you have a more harmonious society. And this is another very important principle in Buddhism. Harmony is really required for the spiritual path to work. And obviously you know why, right? If you don't feel that you have harmony with the people around you, if you feel that you are arguing with people around you, that there isn't any common understanding of what is going on, it feels really, it feels bad. Yeah, you can't really, you don't have any peace of mind. You're thinking about all these issues all the time. Your mind is stirred up. But when there is a sense of harmony, when there's a sense that we're all kind of moving in the same direction, when we may have our disagreements, we will inevitably have our disagreements, but still there's a general sense of shared values moving in the same direction. And when you have that sense of harmony, you feel at ease, you feel relaxed, you feel that other people around you appreciate you, you feel that you appreciate the people around you. It's mutual. And when there is that mutual appreciation, then, of course, you start to feel, have the ability to come here, sit down, be peaceful, feel joy and happiness inside. Yeah, this is kind of the idea of coming here on Friday nights and on Saturdays or whatever, to experience some of these beautiful qualities within that are available. But it is founded on the idea of harmony. And in the suttas, the Buddha uses some expressions to talk about this. He talks about blending like milk and water. Yeah, not like oil and water. Oil and water is no good, milk and water is good. Because milk and water, it blends perfectly. Yeah, there is no kind of separation. Oil and water, it means that it's not going very well. So be more like milk and water, not so much like oil and water. Yeah, we don't want to see any oil around here, we want to see milk and water. So please make sure you are the milky kind, and then we're going to be in business. So, yeah, blending like milk and water. Seeing each other or regarding each other with kindly eyes. Yeah, when you look at the fellows around you here at the Buddha Society, or wherever it is that you may be with your fellow Buddhist, how do you look at them? Do you look at them with a sense of love, a sense of care, of appreciation? Or do you look at them with, they disagree with me about the Abhidhamma. Yeah, okay, no way I'm going to like them. Yeah, they say that there are so many mind moments in the kind of one stretch or whatever. I say there's many more mind moments. I don't like that person. Or I don't know what you think. Please don't make arguments about the Abhidhamma because it doesn't matter. Leave the Abhidhamma to one side. If you don't know what the Abhidhamma is, never mind. Forget about it. That's good. We see each other with kindly eyes, yeah, regarding, looking at each other with a sense of care and understanding. Yeah. It's one of the beautiful ideas of living together in the Buddhist world. It's a high ideal, and it's difficult to do with all people around you, but we can certainly improve that, because there is a lot of goodness in a place like this. There is a lot of kindness. There's many good hearts. And if we look deeper into the person, we will be able to see the goodness there. And when we see the goodness there, something starts to happen. You start to look at people in a different way. And when you do that, you become peaceful. Meditation starts to work. The Buddha says, when you have harmony, then you feel gladness. When you feel gladness, you feel joy. When you feel joy, you feel tranquility. These are all the aspects of the meditation path. When you feel tranquility, you feel happiness. Sukha or bliss is a better translation. When you feel bliss, the mind is stilled. And stilling the mind is one of the most important aspects of the path of meditation. When the mind becomes really, really peaceful, profoundly peaceful, that is where the path really starts to come together. So it comes from harmony. When the harmony is not there, then we have a problem. So to the extent that these sustainable development goals promote harmony, to that extent they are useful for Buddhism. So we should support these kind of goals. That's what I'm trying to say. These are things that we should be involved in as Buddhists, and we should kind of applaud the fact that we are using this, doing these things in the world, because it's good for everyone, and it's also good for spiritual practice. But there's one more thing which I think we should do, and that is to actually also help kind of develop these goals a little bit, and asking ourselves, what can we maybe add to these particular goals? And to give you an example of what I have in mind, I'm going to start out with one kind of fairly unusual example, perhaps. And this is the example of the Buddha arising in the world. The Buddha was born about 2,500 years ago. He was born in the Ganges Plain. And he wandered around in the Ganges Plain for about 45 years, teaching the Dhamma. But why was the Buddha born in the Ganges Plain? Why wasn't he born in Perth? One good reason, there was no Perth, right? That's a pretty good reason. But why wasn't he born here, at this place, whatever that was? Why wasn't he born in, 2,500 years ago? What Rome existed. Why wasn't he born in Rome? Why wasn't he born in, one of those ancient cities in China? What is Xi'an or whatever it's called? Why was he born in the Ganges River? What's so right about the Ganges River in that area, that he was born there? And this is kind of interesting to think, because the reason why I would say that he was born in the Ganges River is that the conditions in that area were right for a Buddha to arise. It is not easy to become a Buddha, right? It's pretty difficult. Is anyone here trying to become a Buddha? No one. Okay. Everyone has got the right view. No need to become Buddha. Become an Arahant instead. But it's not easy to become a Buddha. And the arising of a Buddha in the world really happens when certain conditions are fulfilled. What are those conditions? And to me, it looks like those conditions were fulfilled pretty much in the Ganges Plain. And that's why the Buddha was born there, because that's where you had the opportunity to become a Buddha. What are those qualities? Well, first of all, you need a society that appreciates people who practice the spiritual path, who appreciates people who practice a kind of asceticism, if you like, because maybe this is a kind of asceticism. People who appreciate people who leave the home life, and go into the forest or go into the mountains just to pursue a spiritual practice. Not all societies appreciate these kind of things. It is not always easy to find. And then a society where they actually are willing to support such monastics and spiritual practitioners. In ancient India, all you have to do is go out into the village. And if you wear robes and you shave your head, yeah, like if you look a bit like I do and Venerable Dhammadipa does, and you go into the village, lo and behold, they will give you food. Yeah, this was true 2,500 years ago. It is true today. Yeah. And they may not be Buddhist, and the chances of an ordinary village in India being Buddhist is actually very, very small, because Buddhism is a very tiny minority in India. But they recognize you straight away as a religious person. If you go into the local village, they will give you food. Yeah, you might get food poisoning, but you will get food. So this is beautiful, right? This is something very, I don't know, it's something really attractive about this. And this was true 2,500 years ago. You left the home life and you sustained yourself by walking into the village and receiving the offerings of the local people. They would support you. And in return, they would make merit because they would do an act of kindness. And also, they might get some really beautiful spiritual teachings. Yeah, there's something really beautiful about that kind of connection between the lay Buddhist on the one hand, and then, or the lay, not even Buddhist necessarily, the lay people on the one hand, and then the spiritual practitioners on the other. And that is part of the same tradition that we are carrying on in the present day. It's very powerful and very beautiful. And I rejoice just by sitting in our monastery sometimes. People come in and they support us. They bring all this beautiful food to support the monastics. Yeah, there's something very heart-touching about this, which I find very, very inspiring. Yeah. So this is one of the things that was possible in ancient India, and I think why the Buddha arose there, because these conditions were in place. But there was one more condition that was in place in ancient India, and that was that there was already a lot of spiritual practice going on. Yeah. So when the Buddha started out, he had his own teachers when he began. These teachers known as Alara Kalama and Udraka Ramaputta, and also other teachers. And these teachers, they already had very high levels of spiritual achievements. Yeah, they were practicing samadhi, the deep meditation I was talking about just before, profound states of stillness, the complete unification of the mind with profound ecstasy and bliss and all of these kind of things. So the gap from those states to the full enlightenment of the Buddha is not that great. Yeah, these teachers are already close to the pinnacle of what's possible according to Buddhist meditation. And because they are close, the Buddha doesn't have to traverse a very large kind of area of spiritual practice to reach the full awakening. So spiritual practice was already very profound. Only a little bit was missing. And so these are some of the conditions that were available in ancient India. Now, one of the interesting things about this is again the word of the Buddha, the suttas. One of the things it says in those suttas is that the Buddha is always born in India. Jambudipa. Yeah? So remember, there's not only one Buddha. There's Buddhas arise every now and again. Right? There have been previous Buddhas. There will be future Buddhas. But whenever a Buddha is born, he's born in India. Does that make any sense? Okay, the previous Buddha, that was about, we don't know how long ago, yeah, we have no idea, long, 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 billion, millions of years ago, we have no idea how long ago it was. Other Buddhas were in previous universes, yeah, we assume here the universe kind of going through cycles. Another Buddha would have been in a previous universe. Another Buddha would be in a future universe. So how does it make sense to say that we're born in India if you are in a different universe? Does India exist in exactly the same way in every universe? It sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? And I could never really make any sense of it, because you expect that when you go from one universe to the next one, and everything kind of collapses and it kind of starts to expand again or whatever, that things would look a bit different. It won't be exactly the same. India looks like this triangle on the map with Sri Lanka just beneath. Maybe it will look a bit different. So because I couldn't make any sense of it, I started to think, maybe there's an alternative explanation here. And the explanation that occurred to me is that India is just a name. The Pali word is Jambudipa, the rose apple land, quite literally. It's just a name for whatever country the conditions are right for a Buddha to arise. Any country where those conditions are there, they support ascetics. They give food to ascetics or to spiritual seekers because they respect them, where people are already practicing a very high level of spiritual practice. Such places are called India, and that's why the Buddha always arrives in India, because the conditions are right. What do you think of that theory? Is it rubbish, or does it hold water, or is it dodgy? Okay, tell me later on. You don't have to criticize me straight away. It's too painful, so we'll do it later on. So this is kind of my idea. Yeah? So remember, the Buddha always arises in a place. I think this is true regardless, where the conditions are right. So if we want a Buddha to arise in our world, we have to make the conditions right. Now this is where the sustainable development goals come in, right? So because sustainable development is far more achievable if there's a Buddha around. Because the Buddha helps you with sustainable development. He tells you, don't do this, do that. The Buddha has this big kind of outlook on the world. So our job, our job to be to create the conditions in the world for more Buddhas to arise using the framework of the sustainable development. So we should go to the UN and say, listen, we need to create these conditions in the world. There'll be more peace and harmony here. There'll be more spiritual seekers. There might even be Buddhas in the future. And there certainly will be more people practicing the path in a good way as a consequence. This will feed back into society because these spiritual people, they are good people. They are teachers of many others. They are an example of kindness and compassion, understanding in the world. And because of that, the world will prosper as a consequence. So this is one way of how we can kind of sell some of these Buddhist ideas and create maybe a better world as a consequence. It's a bit far-fetched, but it's an idea anyway. So I hope you can join me in that one, and then we can go to the UN and we can petition them to create more, better conditions for Buddhas to arise in the world. That's kind of my master plan at the moment. Tomorrow it might be a different plan, but right now that's my master plan. But there are other ways, and I think maybe more interesting ways, that we can also have a say on these sustainable development goals. And one of the, I think, important ways, and one of the things that really matter as far as these goals are concerned, it's also about education, education for all, and a quality education for all is part of this the sustainable development goals. And of course, within education, that is where we have a potential for adding something to education. I have always found that much of modern education, when I look at what education that we have in our society, it is very instrumental. It is very much made to make people, to create people, to fit into certain jobs, to fit into certain categories in society, so we can become little cogs in the machinery, right? Every one of us is a cog in the machinery to make the big machinery of society work. And so we're creating these people who have all the right qualities to fit these little kind of holes or cogs in society and make it all work. That's kind of not really what life is about, just being a cog in the machinery, right? You want to have something more. You want to have something meaningful. You want to look out for your own happiness and all these kind of things. So really, from a Buddhist perspective, because Buddhism is all about meaning and happiness and all these kind of things, from a Buddhist perspective, education should be slightly different, I think, from what we have today. It should be more about how to develop personal happiness. As part of my research, before I came here today, you'd be surprised I do research before I give these talks. As part of my research, I went online. And online, I Googled The Wall, Pink Floyd, The Wall. Does anyone know about Pink Floyd, The Wall? Okay, we have a few in the back there nodding their head. Okay, Pink Floyd, The Wall is, and this was kind of a video from Pink Floyd, The Wall. It's kind of this dystopian idea of education, how does it go again? We don't need no education. This kind of how I'm not going to try to sing it because that's going to be a little bit over the top. I'm too embarrassed to do that, to tell you the truth. But and there's all of these school kids that are being kind of formed. And there's one scene there in this video where the school kid is a meat grinder, and the school kids are fed into the meat grinder, and the teacher grinds the kids, and they come out as kind of as meat on the other end, minced meat on the other end. And the idea is that we are all just like a brick in this wall. Yeah, we're part of this large kind of tapestry of things. I think it's a bit like being a cog in the machinery of existence or of society. Yeah, so I did a bit of research to kind of look back at this is how I was shaped. I was a teenager when that album was released in the late 70s. So I remember this very well. It was kind of really big in those days. That's how I grew up, just in case you were wondering here. So, that is kind of a slightly dystopian idea of education. And I think there is some truth to it, right? It is not entirely wrong what they are saying here. And I think that we should have a much better society if we actually brought in education that focuses more on values. What is it that makes us happy? Understanding psychology, understanding the power of generosity, kindness, forgiveness, compassion, these kind of things, to actually create better lives for ourselves individually and also for harmony and society at large. I think more emphasis on that, on what actually makes us personally tick, gives us more meaning in a sense. There is no meaning in just being a cog in the machinery, but there's a lot of meaning if you feel that you are developing yourself, you're changing your own mind, and you're changing your own life as a consequence. So I think this is really where we can have something to add as Buddhists. Yeah, because as Buddhists, we have a lot to say about this particular area. And one of the things, one of the kind of fundamental and beautiful teachings of Buddhism is the teaching on sila, on virtue, yeah, on morality, if you like. This is, to my mind, an area where Buddhism has a lot to add to the world. In this study I was talking about in Thailand, where they were studying kind of the Buddhist contribution to sustainable development, they were focusing on two things in Buddhism: sila, which is virtue, and wisdom, panya, on the other hand. These were the two things they were looking at. And part of the reason, I think, is because Buddhist morality is very interesting and very profound. And this is something I think that the whole world could do well with learning more about. So how does Buddhist morality work? And I will just give you a very brief outline today. Really, it is worth a whole talk of its by itself, but just a very, very brief outline of the idea of Buddhist morality. It's a very flexible moral system, and that is why it is useful. A lot of moral systems around the world, they are often like rules, yeah, commandments or five precepts or whatever. And rules can be very useful. That's why we have precepts in Buddhism as well, because rules kind of lay down some basic ideas of how we should live our lives. So don't kill living beings, don't steal, these kind of things. Yeah, and they all make a lot of sense if you want to have a good society and you want to feel good about yourself. But rules never really get to the essence of what morality is about. Rules are kind of square. They don't have kind of smooth edges. They have sharp edges. Either you are within the rule or you are outside. Yeah, they don't really look at how the underlying ideas that actually make morality work, what morality really is, it doesn't really understand that properly. So there's a deeper layer to this in the suttas, the word of the Buddha. And the Buddha says, well, what morality really is the idea of doing actions that are good for other people, good for yourself, and good for both, right? So whenever we do an act that encourages or helps the happiness of other people, or the well-being of other people, or the reduction of suffering in other people, and also ourselves, then we are doing an act of kindness. In other words, there is a relationship between morality really means how we make others feel, if you like. And if they feel more happiness, then it is a moral act. And that kind of makes a lot of intuitive sense, right? And this is kind of the way morality often also is defined in kind of our secular societies. The idea that when we do something with out of kind, which is helpful for others, is moral. If we do something that is bad for others, it is immoral. But also for ourselves. And that is maybe one of the important Buddhist contributions, that we also include ourselves in the education as well. So that is... a very important point of Buddhist morality already. And that is a point that we can use as a general guide in our life for when we're acting morally and immorally. It can also be used by institutions, yeah, by governments, whether they are treating their people in the right way, whether all of these institutions are doing the right thing or not. There is one little problem with this kind of definition of morality, and that is that we don't always know what is in the best interest of other people. Sometimes we may want to make other happy, but actually we make them more miserable. We try our very best. I'm going to give you a gift. I don't want that gift. That's a bad gift. I wanted something else. And you make the person miserable because actually they were a bit ungrateful. You have to admit it if that's what they say. But sometimes we just don't know exactly what makes other people tick, makes them happy. And so there is another way, an even more profound way of thinking about the idea of morality, especially in the personal realm. And that is the idea of intention. And the idea of intention is, as long as I want, as long as I desire the happiness of other people, as long as I desire to be a benefit to others and to myself again, this idea of two things at the same time, as long as that intention is there, then you are doing a moral act. Because at the very least, you're doing your very best. You may not always succeed, but you're doing your very best to actually ensure that we have a better world, that other people also are happy. And that is the kind of the Buddhist contribution to the idea of morality. It is based on the idea that everyone feels, everyone wants to be happy, everyone wants positive feelings in this world. No one wants to have more negative feelings. If you can avoid to break a leg, you would avoid breaking a leg. Is that true? I'm always unsure when I say this, and whether I'm universalizing a bit too much. Is anyone who prefer to break a leg if they had a chance? No, okay, good. I got it right, it seems. But sometimes people are strange. There are always some outliers. You don't know what they actually makes them tick, so it's kind of hard. There's always someone at the back, far away in the back somewhere. Actually, I prefer like to break a leg. I can't see them today. That's good. Okay. But basically, that is the truth of things, right? That is what makes the world work, or makes the world tick. The idea of feelings are so important. And so having a system of morality based around that makes a lot of intuitive sense. And then coming back to the idea of intention, and it comes, and it sort of makes us, there's so many of these weird ethical dilemmas in the world that philosophers come up with all of these strange ethical dilemmas, you don't know which way to go, whatever. But by using an ethics of intention that I'm proposing now, or rather which is the Buddha's thing, it actually circumvents so many of those problems. That is a kind of beautiful contribution to the idea of sustainable development right there. Bring this into education, a broad outlook on ethics and morality and kindness and all of these kind of things. And then it starts to become very interesting and powerful. So these are some of the Buddhist contributions, to the world of sustainable development. But when we want to look at Buddhist contributions, we should look at those things that are really special in Buddhism. What are the ideas that Buddhism brings to the world that are unique to the Buddhist teachings? And there is one idea, more than anything else, that is really unique to Buddhism, that no other religion, no other philosophy shares with Buddhism. And that is the idea of non-self. The idea of non-self is the idea that there is no inherent essence in human beings, that we are this kind of bunch of various experiences or mental and physical phenomena, but there is no final thing you can say is the real me, because things are always changing. This is the most profound aspect, if you like, of Buddhism. It's the one thing that Buddhism has which is unique in the whole world of philosophy and religion. And so when we look at what Buddhism can contribute to the world, we should look in these areas that are very special or are unique to Buddhism. And there are some very interesting consequences of the idea of non-self. I'm going to bring out a couple of these consequences. And these are consequences I've talked about before many, many times. But I like to repeat myself because it's easy for me here. It's also important, right? It's really, really important to repeat ourselves because these things are forgotten so easily. And if you present it every time and every time with a slightly different angle, with a slightly different emphasis, it sinks in a different way. So I actually like to repeat myself, both for my own benefit, but also for the benefit of everyone else. Because I also get to hear it when I speak it, right? This is the advantage of being a Dhamma teacher. You get to hear Dhamma a lot because you teach a lot. You never thought about it. Did you think about that before? Okay, maybe not. But if you want to, that's one of the big advantages of being a monk, right, or a nun, is that you get this chance to teach. You hear the Dhamma all the time and you read the suttas and all these kind of things. So how does the idea of non-self translate into something practical? We want to take the idea of morality in a deeper direction. Yeah, the idea here is to create something we can put into the education system so we can make better citizens out of humanity. We can create, can come closer to these sustainable development goals. And one of the beautiful consequences of this teaching is that if you don't have any inherent essence in you, then who are you? And who you are in that case, you are basically all the cause and conditions, all the things that have worked on you, that have influenced on, have had an influence on you in this life and also in previous lives. Yeah, your teachers, your parents, your environment, all the people in your life, all the places you have been, all of these things have formed you and have shaped you into becoming the person you are now. That is who you are. Yeah. So what that means is that the person you are now is all of these conditions from the past. And so you are almost like these habits and this causality, all this thing that have worked on you, you are a product of that. And it means you haven't really got all that much free will. Yeah, it means you are a product of the past. You are a little bit like a robot. And the program you're running on is all the things that have influenced you in this life and previous lives. And once you start to see a person more like a robot, less like an autonomous individual, you start to think about human beings in a very entirely new way. They start to look different. Because what it means is that if someone is angry with you, if someone behaves towards you in a bad way, in a negative way, actually, instead of thinking that they are acting badly towards me out of autonomous reasons because they are an evil person or whatever, you start to realize they're acting like that, not because they really want to act like that, but because they are forced to act like that. Their past conditioning, all of these things that have worked on them are making them make stupid choices right now. And that stupid choice happens to hurt you because they are saying something bad. They are doing something bad. Yeah? And it changes your attitude to the people around you. And because when you see that someone is trapped in this way by the past, trapped in their personality, as I like to say, because your personality is shaped by all of these things, when someone behaves badly, you feel compassion for them, because they are trapped, they are forced to do bad and stupid things. They can't really change themselves. Not at that moment anyway, maybe in the long run they can, but at that moment they are trapped by those causes and conditions. It's a beautiful way of thinking about humanity, because it changes a person from thinking, instead of feeling me, why are they treating me badly? Instead of being self-centered, and it's painful to be self-centered, right? Because you are in your small little world and the world outside seems hostile and scary. But the moment you change around and you start to have compassion for that other person instead, it opens up your heart, it opens up your mind, you kind of spread out into the whole world. And it's a beautiful feeling that arises in place of fear and insecurity. This does not mean, I should say straight away, that we should not be careful. Of course, if there are dangerous people around, we should lock the doors and we should ensure that they don't hurt us and all of these kind of things. We should take precautions, we should do the right thing. And sometimes there are people who come to the Buddha site that are not, you know, who may have problems, and for that reason they do bad things or whatever. And so we have to take caution, of course. That's not what it means. It just means that our inner attitude to that person, even though we take precaution, we also have compassion, sympathy and understanding at the same time. That is the idea. Instead of being angry with the other person, you have sympathy and compassion and take precaution at the same time. And the Buddha had a very beautiful simile for how to reflect on people who have lots of bad qualities. If someone comes who speaks badly, who acts badly, who thinks badly, and everything about their whole character is negative in a way. When someone like that comes along, the Buddha says, you should think of them like a sick person. Yeah, they are like a sick person. Why? Because a sick person, if the sick person doesn't get any help, if the sick person doesn't get any medicine or a doctor or whatever, they will go maybe eventually to their own demise. They will die because of that sickness if it is a serious sickness. Yeah, so they will go to a very negative future as a consequence. It's exactly the same thing with a bad person. From the Buddhist point of view, if you have many, many bad qualities, your future is going to be a bad one, right? Even in this life, if you have many bad qualities, you feel bad about yourself. You haven't got any self-esteem. You feel kind of miserable. You have many bad thoughts going through your mind there, let alone what happens after you die. That's even worse. And so this person doesn't know what they're doing. They are destroying their own life by behaving in a bad way without realizing what they're doing, thinking they're doing good things. How can you not have compassion for such a person? Compassion is the only logical outcome of seeing the world in this particular way. So you can see how powerful it is. And this comes from the idea of non-self. If you only remember that much, that beings are conditioned to be the way they are, it changes your attitude, your understanding of everything around us. It makes us better human beings as a consequence. It enhances our morality and our kindness in the world and changes our outlook fundamentally. And what is interesting, of course, in this context is that the Buddhist idea of non-self is gradually being accepted by society at large. If you start to see much of modern psychology and modern philosophy, they look at the world in exactly that way. Yeah, that there is no self, there is no inherent essence in human beings. Look at some of the greatest philosophers in the fairly modern world, like David Hume. Yeah, David Hume apparently said something to the effect that if you look at a human being, all you see is this endless sequence of perceptions arising and passing away, nothing ever being constant. I'm just paraphrasing now, I can't remember exactly what I looked this up a while ago, I can't remember right now. And that is very, very close to the idea of non-self in Buddhism. So the world is open, I think, to these ideas. What we have to do is to point out the consequences of these ideas, what they mean in terms of compassion, what they mean in terms of morality and our outlook in the world. This is our job as Buddhists, because that is difficult for the world maybe to understand. So this is one of those things I brought up when I spoke at this conference in Bangkok, and because I thought it was very interesting. But the other thing I brought up at that particular time, which also has to do with the idea of non-self, is that non-self has another very interesting consequence. It creates more brotherhood and sisterhood in the world. It creates more harmony. It creates more mutual understanding. And the reason for that is because the idea of non-self implies that we are always changing. Yeah? There is no stability inside of us. The Buddha says that this means that there can be no conceit. There can be no sense that I am better than you or I am worse than you, inferiority conceit, superiority conceit, or even equality conceit, right? Equality conceit is the quintessential kind of Buddhist idea. Yeah, who talks about equality conceit? Yeah, no one except for Buddhism. But there can be none of these conceits. And the reason is because there is no basis for comparison. If we are always changing entities, if we are always moving around, some days we are happy and we are virtuous and kind, other days we are miserable and whatever, and maybe we're not so kind, I don't know what happens when you're miserable, you tend to be less kind, right? Does anyone else have that kind of experience? Yeah, that's how things, what life is like, yeah, up and down, back and forth, and not very stable. So if you are always changing, and this other fellow person over here is always changing, at what point do you compare each other? And not only do you change from day to day, but you change over a lifetime. If you are a Buddhist who is practicing this path well, then hopefully you are on this incline going up, right? And you get becoming a better and better person, more and more happy. But maybe there's a scallywag over here who started out really well and who had the opportunity to become a Buddhist but missed out, right, on that opportunity and going downhill because Buddhism was the opportunity going downhill, yeah, ending up as a mafioso or something like that. And so somewhere these lines cross. So how do we compare people? And maybe then he changes, it goes up again, this one goes down. I don't know. Any, you know, all these combinations are possible. So how can we compare each other? And of course the answer is we cannot compare each other. We are always changing. And because we are always changing, it means that we're always moving from one state to another. Some people are born poor, they become wealthy. Some are born wealthy and become poor. Some are born intelligent, they become stupid. Some are stupid, they become intelligent, maybe. Some are born high social status, they become low social status. Some are born as men, they become women. Some are women, they become men. This is what happened these days. These days, almost anything of these things are possible. So many changes. So which one of those people are we? Are we that man or that woman? Are we the wealthy person or the poor person? The intelligent one or the stupid one? And then you take into the idea, the fact of multiple lifetimes. If there are multiple lifetimes, the potential for change increases dramatically. In a past life, who were you? Were you a man? A woman? Were you born in Asia? In Africa? In the Americas? On Mars? It's hard to know, right? You could have been a Martian in a past life. I don't know if that would be good or bad. Were you handicapped or non-handicapped? Were you wealthy? Were you poor? Were you... did you have psychiatric problems, perhaps, in the past lives? All of these things are certainly possible. There is no end anymore to the possibilities of change, right? And you start to realize at that point that all of these people, they are already inside of you, because when you take into account enough lifetimes, guaranteed, you have been one of these people before. And if you don't make an end to the problem that we have in this life, you will be one of these people again in the future. Because we have been everything. The Buddha says it's difficult to find any being in this world who has not previously been our mother, father, brother, sister, daughter, or son. Yeah. In the same way, we have been everyone in this world before. And what that means is that when you start to see someone who is different from you, who comes from a different culture, who has different ideas, someone who is handicapped, someone who has psychological problems, someone who is wealthy, someone who is poor, someone who looks different from you, instead of having a feeling of separation, instead of othering is this word they use when you feel separate from someone else, instead of othering, you start to see yourself in that person. This is me. And the moment you see yourself in that other person, whoever they are in this world, wherever they were born, you create a very powerful human connection. Because now you know there isn't really any difference, there isn't really any separation between us anymore. If you can be them, they can be you. We're just swapping places every now and again. You take away all these barriers in our life. And at that point, instead of othering, then real compassion, real understanding starts to arise. Yeah, other people are not other, they are like you. There's this understanding that comes from that. And at that moment, instead of being separating ourselves into tribes like we love to do in humanity, this is my tribe, that is your tribe, I will war with your tribe. No, you start to see yourself, you also are part of that other tribe. And because you are part of that other tribe and they are part of you, you love them just as much as you love the people in your own tribe. We get rid of this tribalism. We get rid of this stupid nationalism in the world whereby we love to fight each other, all these kind of crazy things that we do. And instead, we try to understand each other in a much more profound sense. So these are very powerful and beautiful ideas to create more compassion and understanding in the world. It's kind of amazing how an idea like non-self, which may sound so theoretical, which may sound so profound, also has very practical implications in the world. And if we can bring some of these ideas to the table, and I believe the world is willing, able, ready to accept many of these ideas, precisely because the modern outlook actually fits with these ideas quite well, then we can make a big contribution to the world. And this is a very specific Buddhist contribution, because these are very, very specific Buddhist ideas. So this is my suggestion to create a more sustainable development goals. Yeah? Bring this into the education system and make the world a better place as a consequence. And of course, these are ideas that each one of us, each one of you, myself, everyone can also use in our own personal lives, because they are very, very powerful ideas. If you use these ideas consistently, if you brainwash yourself with these ideas, yeah, so you kind of start, after a while, they really become part of you, guaranteed they have a massive impact on your life. Okay, that is the talk for tonight. So there you are. Okay, everyone, so now is a chance to ask some questions and make some comments. So let's see what happens. We have some questions from outside. Thank you, Renee. Does anyone here have any questions before we start? Eddie has a question. Surprise, surprise. Okay, Eddie.
John Bramali, very interesting, deep, unusual talk. You know, you talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs and Buddhism. Mm. Now we know Maslow's hierarchy of needs. As we climb up, you know, we don't know, we can't see, don't know what happens on top. You know, once we reach the top, self-actualization, we look down, we can see everything.
Yeah,
can this self-actualization be compared to Buddhism's realization of emptiness, like no self, you know? like life is a big bullshit, you know, if you look at it all, it's a big bullshit.
Yeah.
And also the other one is the seven factors of enlightenment, you know?
Yeah.
The highest is equanimity, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Can this be compared to that?
I think that Maslow's ideas were a bit more humble than that, to be honest with you. I think Maslow... Because I think Maslow was probably thinking more in terms of, developing our highest potential in the more worldly sense. I don't think he probably had some spiritual ideas as well, but I don't think they were quite at that level, because this is a very high level. But I think as Buddhists, we can interpret in that way. Yeah, and that is to me the important thing.
Comparable.
Yeah. So I think we can interpret in that way. We can, because for us, that is what self-actualization is. It is the practicing of the seven factors of awakening, the practicing of the whole spiritual path, eventually ending in emptiness and all of that. So I basically agree with you.
The whole thing, you know, the realization, self-realization, you know, and the equanimity, realizing that life is a big bullshit, you know. Once if you realize this thing, you know, we have all the problems, all bullshit, you know, it comes to
you. Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it. So I will. Okay, thanks, Eddie. Very good. Anyone else? Everyone happy? Yeah. Everyone content? Okay. Okay, over here, please.
I was interested in what you said about thinking of people as if they were like robots, and then you could look at them and say that, okay, you can't get angry with them because they have been conditioned to be like that. And then the next thing you said was really interesting, and you said that therefore the only response to this is that you must have compassion to them. But actually, if they're like robots, they're like toasters or something, you can just chuck them away and get a new one. So that was not quite... You'd have to explain how the only thing is that they would be compassion when you think of them as just toasters.
Well, they are robots in one sense, but they're not any kind of robot. They're a particular kind of robot, right? So you have to kind of qualify that a little bit. And they are robots with feelings. A toaster doesn't have any feelings, but a human robot has feelings. And that's why you can't toss them away. So the compassion is because you want them to have happiness. Yeah. And so you may be a robot, but you still want to be happy, right? Would you like to be happy or have any preference? Reasonably happy, reasonably content? Yeah. It's better than being miserable anyway. So, and this is the thing, because they are robots with feelings. Yeah, that is why you cannot, and you want them to be happy and well, because that is a natural one, because we want to be happy and well. And that is why you kind of don't chuck them out like toasters. And the thing is that you don't feel like a robot, right? This is kind of the, and this is exactly the problem, because you don't feel like a robot. Actually, that perception is quite, can be quite difficult to develop, because if I don't feel like a robot, my assumption is that you also are not a robot in the same way. So we need to see our own conditioning. And the very part, large part of the path is actually to understand your own conditioning here, and to kind of look at yourself. You know, it's fascinating. When I do something, it feels like it is my choice. Yeah, okay, I'm going to pick up this glass. Pick it up. I'm going to drink water. No. Okay, put it back again. Yeah. This feels like my choice. But very often when I look back on my life, I look back on what I was like 20 years ago, whatever, and I look back on those choices I made then, they don't feel like choices in the same way, quite the same way anymore. When I look back and look at the overall trajectory of my life, actually, it kind of fits a pattern, and I start to see myself a bit more like a robot, because it was almost like I was forced to make those choices. Where do the choices come from? The choices come from past habits, past ways of looking at the world. The choices are kind of made for us through that conditioning. And when you look back, it's easier to see that in the moment it feels like a personal choice, but historically it looks more like that. So you start to more appreciate who you are as a human being, and at that moment you can see the same in others, and then you have even more compassion, because you know they are trapped in this blooming dukkha, yeah, and we got to try to help them out somehow.
Okay, I kind of knew you were going to say we were feeling robots. And then the second thing I was going to ask was with the sustainable goals. You were basically saying the contribution of Buddhism, one contribution is that you can introduce this idea of morality into education. First education and then morality into education. So my question is, but my statement is, but actually the way the modern world works is to separate religion from organization.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know.
Anticipate your question. I just kind of
okay.
As being indeed, and I think that's an important point. I think what I would say is that even in secular schools we can introduce much more psychological content, because this is really psychological content, and I think many of the kind of basic Buddhist ideas are not really all that different from much modern psychology. We can maybe add a little bit, maybe we can give some new angles on these things, just to kind of bring it a little bit further. But the idea, of course, must be that in a secular environment, yes, this teachings have to be secular, but we can do more even in that environment. That's kind of my point. Yes. All right, let's take some questions from overseas. So we have a question from James Shepherd. And the question is how to approach being scared about doing something exhilarating and to approach it with joy instead of fear. Would appreciate your insight. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by doing something exhilarating here, but the kind of the most interesting exhilarating things happens in meditation practice, right? When the meditation starts to get exhilarating and interesting, because you are going quite deep. So how can you approach that meditation with joy instead of fear? First of all, just by taking it gradually, yeah, by getting used to the idea of meditation, getting used to those feelings, so that you sort of don't anticipate too much, and you kind of learn to deal with those feelings as you go along. And as you learn that, you learn that it is just happiness. Why am I afraid of happiness anyway? And gradually you overcome that, and you start to gain the joy of this path of meditation instead of fearing things. So by doing things gradually, systematically, the fear kind of dissipates, because you're not taking any big leaps. I don't really recommend taking big leaps in meditation, because if you do, I know sometimes people do that and they have some amazing experience and they only have it once and never happens again, and that's kind of useless. It's better to do things systematically, slowly, overcoming the fear, overcome the obstacles gradually in this way. The other thing to remember is that many, many people have done these things before you, especially meditation practice, and they came out as far better people as a consequence. So these are good things, good states, good qualities that enhances your life as a human being. So people have been there before. There's nothing to be afraid of. What is to be afraid of in meditation, the only time you should be careful in meditation, is if your mind starts to get imbalanced, if you start to feel confused, you start to feel a bit deluded, you start to feel even fear. I mean, if it's too much fear, it's not a good thing. If it's a little bit, it doesn't matter. But if it's too much, that too can be bad. So you need to have a balanced kind of mind. That is what, as long as your mind is balanced and you're feeling good, there's nothing to be afraid of. Okay, then we have a question from Bolivia. Wow, that's really cool. Hello, Bolivia. I hope you're still there. Please stay with us. I have never heard a question from Bolivia before, so this is exciting. So let's see what you have to say. After some years and a lot of money invested in studying chemical engineering, I find myself in a difficult situation of having to pass a very difficult subject that can make me lose my degree here. This makes me very afraid of the future, how it will affect my parents emotionally and what my livelihood will be like. What can I do to live peacefully, whatever the result? Okay, this is a very good question, because this is the sort of thing that human beings find themselves in quite regularly, I would say. We all have these kind of difficult situations sometimes in life that seems like we're at a crossroads, and it's kind of one side looks really dangerous and the other side looks like it's safe. But that is an illusion. It isn't actually like that. We come to these crossroads, and then maybe you do fail your exam, but then actually the world turns out to be very different from what you thought it was. Other possibilities open up, things that you never thought were possible suddenly emerge out of nowhere, and suddenly life takes a different turn, and suddenly maybe you find that actually get more happiness by not passing the degree than you had from actually passing it. Maybe by passing the degree you get a really good job, and then getting a good job you get trapped into kind of the rat race in a certain way, and you forget about Buddhism, you never listen to another talk from the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, right? And that's it. And then suddenly you die, and that's it. That was your life, because you passed that blooming degree here. It's bad news, So the thing is that we don't know what the future holds. We don't know what things are going to turn out like. Yes, it may affect your parents emotionally, but what affects your parents far more emotionally than whether you pass your degree or not is how you treat them. If you treat your parents with kindness, a child that treats their parents with kindness is a very beautiful thing. Why? Because the parents are so close to their children. So if you can do that as a child, wow, that is really, really far more important than passing your degree. I would say, the future is just too uncertain. There are too many possibilities are actually out there. It looks like some kind of wall because you can't see beyond it. You don't know what's there. It looks like an important crossroad. But when you get there, the wall crumbles. A new landscape opens up, and suddenly you have possibilities you never dreamed of. So try to think a bit more like that, and then you can relax a bit more, hopefully, and you can be more peaceful. And then if you fail your exam, shrug your shoulders and carry on. All right. Maybe I'm being a bit flippant. I apologize for that if that's the case. Question number 3. This is from Malaika from Poland. My child got brain cancer. Can I meditate for them? Not in intention, but instead of. I see. Instead of them. I don't think that is possible, because meditation is a personal thing, right? But I think it's better to think of it as meditating for them, in the sense of having an intention of kindness. I think that is a better way of thinking about them. Because if you do meditate and you do get some nice results in your meditation, then it will very likely affect your child as well. But meditating instead of someone is not really possible. So as a mother, yeah, take care of your child. Do your very best that you can to support them. And then nature will have to take its course, unfortunately. This is the harsh reality of existence. So you're just going to have to learn from that to the best of your ability. Remember, any really difficult situation in life can lead two ways. Either it can lead to enormous amounts of suffering, which we grieve and have all kinds of problems, or it can lead to suffering plus wisdom. There will always be some suffering. Life cannot be, you cannot have a life without suffering. But if you use those difficult times in a wise way, by standing back, by reflecting, by asking yourself, what can I learn from this? You become a better person. And when you become a better person, you become wiser, and then you get a better life. You can be more help for people around you as a consequence. So see this as an opportunity. Yes, I have no doubt it will be very difficult for you, but see it as an opportunity, and then there is kind of a brightness at the end of the tunnel. And if it is a child, you know, if a child dies, they haven't usually done very many bad things in their life, very likely they will be reborn in a happy destination afterwards. So that is kind of the upside. All right, then we have a question from India, Smita in India. How does one work on guilt? I have done everything I can for my mother, but when I'm not around her, I end up feeling guilty that I'm not taking care of her, neglecting her. Oh, maybe this is the special Indian kind of feeling, because in India, families are so close, right? And so it's easy to, I can understand why you might feel like this. What can you do about this sort of feeling? Well, you just have to kind of know that there's only so much you can do for another person anyway. And sometimes we do too much for other people. In the end, other people have to look after themselves if they want to be happy and have a good life. So sometimes if we do too much, maybe we are not really helping anymore. Maybe we're kind of going the wrong way. You know, one of the things, when I became a Buddhist monk, I realized that I would not see my family all that much afterwards. Yeah, and my family was not very happy with me becoming a Buddhist monk. As you can imagine, that's the same everywhere in the world. Family never happy with the child becoming a Buddhist monk. My family was no different. But I thought about it. I thought, well, what do we really want in life? Do we want quality companionship, quality communication, quality relationships? Or do we want quantity relationships? And to be honest, I would much rather have quality relationship with my family, with my parents, than quantity relationship. Quantity relationship is kind of empty here. We're with them all the time. Yes, maybe we help each other out a little bit, but quality is far more important, because then we care. Then we care in a deep way here. Yeah, we have a sense of metta, of kindness, of compassion for each other. That is what really goes to the heart. And when things go to the heart, they have real meaning here. But the kind of superficial quantity of time together is not so important. So if you make sure that the time that you have with your mother, your mom, is quality rather than quantity, that may mean that you actually have to withdraw a little bit. Because if we are with someone all the time, we get too close, then there is more friction usually. But by withdrawing a little bit and not spending so much time together, you have more time on being, having the right kind of mind state, having more compassion, having more metta, loving kindness, having more balanced kind of mind. Yeah, and that will enable you to give quality instead of quantity. Yeah? That, I think, may be the best way to overcome the guilt, because then you are actually doing the best you can for your mother. Yeah? Question from Germany. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, is life a part of samsara, or is samsara part of life? How do you define life? What is it? For me, life is love. No love, no life. Thank you kindly. It's a very nice question, so thank you for that one. Is life part of samsara, or is samsara part of life? I would say life is samsara. Yeah? There is only one samsara. Samsara is, in Buddhism, is the idea, the perpetual round of death and rebirth. That's samsara. Where does that samsara happen? It happens within each one of us. Yeah, we are the ones who get die, then we get reborn, and these kind of things. So it's part of who we are. So life actually is samsara. Yeah, And what we're trying to end is samsara. We're trying to end the cycle of birth and death. That's how you end samsara. So that is to me, the way the Buddha would have taught this. So what? How do you define life? What is it? Well, life is samsara. Life is this perpetual movement around suffering, happiness, just moving on and on and on, feeling, experiencing feelings, I think, is one of the ways of defining life. Only life experiences feelings, bad feelings, good feelings, neutral feelings. So for me, life is love. I would say a meaningful life is love, right? Life is more than love. Even if you have no love, you're still alive, but it's not a meaningful life. That is what I would be my answer to that question. Okay, everyone. Thank you very much for tonight. So let's just pay respect to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha.